kelp. And kelp itself is a very important member of the marine community. Kelp, particularly giant kelp, can grow to about 200 feet tall. It's called the rainforest of the sea in many places. It supports a wide variety, a myriad of life. So what happens, and what Jim discovered, is that when you didn't have otters, you had these eruptions of the sea urchins. And the sea urchins went through the kelp like living chainsaws, mowed the place down, and then basically, again, did the same sort of thing that happened on Payne's Rock. It drastically changed and simplified this ecological community.
And this sort of pattern seemed to play out itself across the country as well as in Yellowstone.
Yeah, you know, that's been the hard thing to do. Finding these experiments has been very difficult. And so to say that this thing is a universal fact of life, is it takes some looking. It takes a lot of experimentation, and it doesn't absolutely happen this way everywhere. But some places that they've looked, they found it. Some places they haven't found it to be such a powerful force. But one place they have, or at least they suspect they have now, is the wolves of Yellowstone. They were brought back after a 70-year absence in 1995, and since then they've spread to all corners of the park. There's about 300, I think, at last count. But in any respect, the wolves of Yellowstone have brought a new powerful force to that ecosystem, in that they have begun to control the elk, which for many years were doing quite a number on some of the streamside forests of Yellowstone. With the wolves back now, what some of the scientists suspect is that they are, through several mechanisms, one is they reduce the number of elk by a certain amount, but they also change the behavior of the elk. They exhibit what is called an ecology of fear, by which the elk, instead of lounging in these streamside forests and chewing them to the nub year after year, they are a little more skittish. They spend less time there. They spend more time in the uplands, away from these very fragile riparian or streamside communities. And what that has brought along, and what the scientists suspect has happened there, is that we have these little flushes here and there of these streamside trees coming back after many, many years of going nowhere. As I say, ankle height to an elk, now suddenly sprouting 10 feet high. And with them has come this whole plethora of other wildlife in the wake. And in addition to them, we have beavers now returning to Yellowstone. 12 beaver colonies now over the last 10 or 12 years where there were none. And those itself bring a lot of other animals along with them, along with their dams and whatnot. And so there's just been a whole sort of a regrowth or a flourish that's happened since the wolves came back. And although there are still a lot of people who say the jury is out, we need to wait on this a little bit longer, it's beginning to look more and more like at least the wolf is having some significant impact on that ecosystem of Yellowstone.
Well, that is quite a comeback for Yellowstone. You're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Let's move away from the United States and over to Africa for a moment. In your book, you describe an interesting and somewhat cautionary tale about what happens when predators are removed from the ecosystem. I'm talking about the baboons.
Yeah, and that one is, you know, that one's not even published yet, so I should just mention that right off the top. But the data is there, and it should be coming out fairly soon, but it's basically this story. I can give you the general details of it. A researcher there by the name of Justin Brashears from the University of Berkeley has been watching the wildlife of Ghana and the national parks within Ghana for some years now, and he came upon a treasure trove of data which had 40 years of wildlife surveys done by the park guards that gave him a really great time-lapse sort of image of what has been going on with the wildlife of Ghana. And one striking thing he's noticed is that the baboons in many places have increased immeasurably. And in the wake of those increasing baboons, and this he's found not only in Ghana but in looking in anecdotal form across sub-Saharan Africa, the baboons have risen to plague proportions, and they are becoming extreme pests of livestock and crops. They're chasing people around. They tried to abduct little children. People in Uganda now. This is a story that they are the people. There are certain school kids in Uganda now who are staying home from school to guard the crops and the herds. They're school teachers as well. So this is an incredible turnabout for what used to be, you know, people would be concerned about elephants or, you know, lions raiding the flocks or whatnot. But right now, it seems that baboons are doing that. And here's the interesting thing is that where Berchers is finding this phenomenon happening mostly, he's finding also an absence of the lions and leopards that used to live there. So in other words, he believes that in the absence of the lions and the leopards, which have been driven out, poisoned and whatnot, or killed as potential threats of their own, these baboons are reaching plague proportions in their absence and becoming the new pest of Africa, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of pests, let's talk about deer for a brief moment. I chuckled over your chapter, Bambi's Revenge, because as any gardener knows, they are pesty. And apparently, aside from eating my blueberries and trying to trample my corn, they're creating a much more dangerous situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, it's hard to put up with that if you are a gardener to have to deal with that every year in and year out. And that is because we have so many of them, and we have so many fearless deers is another aspect of their behavior that I think accounts for a lot of this. You know, we have them climbing onto people's decks, three-story decks and whatnot. So we have not only a lot more deer, we have a new brand of brazen deer wandering around out there, but it also creates other hazards. It is, in addition to mowing down, you know, your landscaping, it's mowing down the landscaping of natural ecosystems. You know, we are losing in many places the next generation of forests. There are places in Pennsylvania where the commercial timber industry is basically at a standstill. Unless they put a fence around it, they're not growing timber for the next generation. We have places where rare plants are no longer growing because they're being mowed down as soon as they come up. And a couple other things that might touch a little closer to home, we have epidemics of Lyme disease, which are carried by a tick, which reproduces on deer. We also have about 150 people in this country that are dying in auto accidents from collisions with deer. So a lot of different things coming from an overabundance of deer. I just will say this. It's not all because of lack of top predators that we have these deer. I mean, there's a lot of things we've done to make this country very palatable to deer. But these are one of the factors, the loss of its top predators that may be a significant influence on what we see are eruptive numbers of deer and elk in this country.
My guest this morning is wildlife journalist and author William Stoltzenberg. His latest book is Where the Wild Things Were, Life, Death, and Ecological Wreckage in a Land of Vanishing Predators. We have Michelle Dennehy on the line from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Good morning, Michelle.
Hi, good morning.
Can you tell us how your department manages predators in areas such as Forest Park or any of the other parks in and around Portland and the state as a whole?
Sure, but first I just wanted to say that, you know, his point is very well taken, and predators are really important to the ecosystem, and when you don't have them, you can get these out-of-control deer and elk populations, and they will hurt habitat. In Oregon, we understand how important predators are, and we've worked to reverse that trend of predators vanishing. We've recovered cougars. We have healthy bear populations. We're actually now recovering wolves. We had our first wolf pack confirmed back in July, so they're also coming back to Oregon. So, you know, while we recognize that they are very important to the ecosystem, we also have a responsibility to manage cougars, bears, and predators in a way that minimizes risk to human safety and to livestock. So the way that we like to manage that risk is to have sport hunters actually take care, you know, hunt in areas where damage is occurring, and that way we can pay for wildlife management through the sale of hunting licenses and tags. In terms of cougars and bears, now that their populations have been recovered and are healthy, we do allow sport hunting of them through regulated seasons. In fact, those seasons are open right now throughout Oregon. Now, wolves, of course, are a different example. We have very low populations, so, of course, we don't allow any hunting of wolves at this point. In terms of managing them, again, we do regulated sport hunting, and when we see damage, and I think it's important to define that, just seeing a bear or cougar is not considered damage. It's not a cause for alarm. It's when a bear or cougar kills livestock, kills a pet, or acts dangerously or aggressively, for example, by being seen in daylight and showing no wariness of humans. That's when we get concerned. And if that does occur, if you see it taking your livestock or taking your pet, you are, by Oregon law, allowed to kill that bear or cougar. You must call Oregon State Police or ODFW immediately after doing so, so we can investigate. But, you know, the best way to avoid that is particularly in areas, you know, in Portland proper, you're really not probably going to see a bear or cougar, but in any forested area that has a prey base, maybe out towards Sandy more, you can assume that there's probably bears and cougars around, and the best way to avoid conflict is to just not feed them. So you don't want to have bird feeders out because the bears like that. You want to cover up your garbage cans and make them inaccessible to bears. And
right.
That exactly is the biggest problem we see, is people inadvertently feeding wildlife and creating problems.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Will, I have a question. Someone from the station would like to know, what about predator birds? Has there been a study about the impact of raptors and owls, eagles, on the environment and what their removal or their lower numbers would mean?
Well, from this cascade perspective that I've been speaking about in this book, the one that I mention, and this one is not a really precise scientific study, but in places in South America, for example, the harpy eagle is considered one of the topmost predators of the tropical forest, and that has been implicated in at least one experiment in Venezuela now, whereby the loss of harpy eagles along with jaguars and pumas has resulted in an explosion of prey at the base of the food chain and wiping out these little island forests. That's become a very, very famous study that's been conducted by John Terborg out of Duke University. But, along with raptors and along with a lot of the other beasts, mammals included, there just aren't a whole lot of studies that have been able to show these cascades, mainly because we have not been able to get a handle on how these wide-ranging animals, you know, they live for long periods of time. They're really difficult to study, and so the story, the really sound scientific studies are pretty few. But I would not doubt that there are some that I'm not even aware of that exhibit these cascades in American raptors.
You mentioned in your book a somewhat new phenomenon that's been noticed by scientists. A void was created, and now it appears that killer whales are filling that void. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I have to mention that is one of the most controversial studies that I've come upon in this idea of these ecological cascades resulting from the loss of the top predators. The idea there, and it's one that has been promoted by Jim Estes of the sea otter fame and some of his colleagues, is that we've recently seen within the last 10 years or so, these sea otters have begun again to decline in the Aleutians. And the big question is, of course, why? They're not dying from sickness. They're not being hunted that we know of by fur hunters anymore. So what's going on with the sea otters? The idea is that the main hypothesis forwarded by Jim Estes is that they are being eaten, a lot of them, by killer whales. And that begs the question, why are killer whales eating these very tiny prey when we know that killer whales are more accustomed to eating much larger prey, sea lions and the great whales and porpoises and whatnot? The idea there, and this is where the controversy comes in, what Estes thinks may have happened is that after World War II, there was a great depletion of the great whales in the North Pacific. The whalers went sailing, and with their heavy equipment and their big boats and exploding harpoons, they took somewhere around 3.5 billion pounds of whale meat out of the North Pacific. Now that, to Estes and company, amounted to one big amount of killer whale sustenance, and perhaps, just perhaps, that some of the killer whales, or maybe all of them just to a little bit, found themselves a little bit hungry and started eating their ways down the food chain, eventually leading to what we have now is crashing populations of sea lions and sea otters in the North Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the conclusion of your book, you were talking about how several biologists, or I believe it was a panel of 12, had come to the conclusion that probably one of the best ways to bring our ecosystems in line was to rewild the United States or areas where predator populations were quite low, similar to what has happened. Now, I believe the wolves in Oregon have wandered in on their own, but I'm not sure on that point.
Yes,
maybe
you're
Michelle.
Correct. You're okay. Correct. They're coming over from Idaho, where they were established through the Endangered Species Act.
Okay. And Will, you talk about what our landscape looked like 13,000 years ago. Can you briefly touch on what predators were like 13,000 years ago and then come back to the question of rewilding?
Sure. Yeah, it was, from what I understand, a magnificent place. You know, it rivaled, it exceeded modern-day Africa in terms of the mega beasts wandering in this country. We had all of the complement that we have now, the wolves, and we had cougars, we had jaguars, we also had saber-toothed cats, and we had lions, and we had cheetahs, and we had mammoths and ground sloths the size of elephants. It was just a spectacular place, and it all sort of went over a cliff at about 13,000 years ago when it also happened we were coming out of an ice age, and a lot of people think that had a lot to do with it. But it also happened that people first came into this country about 13,000 years ago from Siberia, and they happened to be mammoth hunters, as it turns out. They had these exquisite long spear points, and so the idea is that maybe they had perhaps a very big hand in the decimation, elimination of a lot of these mega beasts. Now, what the rewilders are thinking is that, you know, if we really want to restore this country to its grandest, glorious state, we should go back to that time when really this things were kind of pulsing with whole blood in this continent, and that would take us back to 13,000 years ago. And so they're actually suggesting that maybe we need to think about some proxies for some of these animals that are no longer here. The mammoths, we have elephants in places in captivity that, you know, maybe we should try them out in North America. We have lions, of course, in captivity that maybe, again, we could put some of these missing pieces that are very close approximates of what used to live here 13,000 years ago, try them out in these big fenced experiments and see what happens to the landscape, because their idea is that right now the status quo, missing so many of these animals as we do, is abnormal, and we are having some repercussions that are not exactly good for biological diversity.
So they were advocating a fenced landscape, not just bringing them in and letting them roam, running amok.
Yeah, there was a lot of misunderstandings about that proposal. One, it was a proposal. It was a thought. You know, it was a question thrown out there. What do we think? Well, they got a lot of people answering back who hadn't even read the report. And yeah, the idea was that, as they like to say, they weren't about to back up a truck full of lions to Topeka and dump them out. You know, what their idea was to try these big fenced experiments in these big open spaces of land that are unpeopled, and you know, run the experiment and see what happens. And you know, it met with a lot of resistance because people weren't quite willing to go that far or to really read what they were saying.
Well, I was pretty amazed throughout your book that these biologists and their studies were met with resistance quite often, and especially intriguing was the story of the gentleman in Pennsylvania. I believe he worked for their Department of Fish and Wildlife, and he was just trying to open up hunting, deer hunting, and his reception was not that wonderful. And I believe he's left and gone to the West. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was Gary Ault, and you know, he was for a long time in Pennsylvania, bear biologist, and used to crawl into bear dens and pull out cubs, and you know, take weights and measurements and everything. So the guy had, you know, a fair amount of experience in the field. But then, you know, so many years in the field, he also noticed that there was a problem going on with the deer herd. And Pennsylvania has one of the highest deer herds in the country. And as I said, they are losing a lot of forest diversity because of that. But the problem is that the deer hunters in Pennsylvania don't want to shoot anymore. They want to continue to have these huge herds of deer. And so they resist any efforts to lower the herds. And what Gary Ault did, he volunteered, took a position as a deer biologist for the Pennsylvania Game Commission, and went around the country, or I should say around the state, pitching this idea that we really need to consider what our deer herd is doing to the future of our forest. We need to bring the herds down. And yeah, he was met with huge resistance. He was shouted down. He was spat at. I mean, he had to start wearing a bulletproof vest to work. I mean, yeah, it was just a really ugly scene from people who did not want to be told that their forests were dying and that their favorite animal was at the root of it all.
And you also discussed the drop in attendance at national parks. And can you just real briefly tell our listeners how many hours a week does the average child spend outside? I was shocked and mortified when I read this.
Well, I think it's down to like a half an hour now, which, you know, and the idea behind that, it just doesn't bode well for, you know, if we want this idea, the idea that this country is going to be saved by people who have a keen interest in nature, it just doesn't seem like they're training well for the task, and that they're just not getting outside very much. What they're doing, and you can probably guess this, is they're sitting in front of video screens and playing games or watching things, surfing the internet or whatnot. They're getting their nature by virtual reality.
So if they're not hiking through the woods and they don't see the trillium and the lady slippers disappearing, well, actually, if they never recognize them in the first place, then as adults, they're never even going to recognize that those species of plants were gone.
That's exactly it. I mean, that's what's called the shifting baseline. You know, they start off thinking that this is what nature is all about, and they don't realize what they're missing in the end. And it's a tragic case because, you know, some of us, and I don't mean to speak about myself in particular, but some of these naturalists who are out there, the ones who are crying the most about what we're losing, they're the ones that see it all out there, and they see what we're losing, and they're just not getting the message across to people who say, you know, what's the problem? It's always been this way since I've been a kid. Well, that's the problem, you know, that they're starting with a very low, low baseline. And, you know, it's just, it just doesn't lead very it doesn't lead to very pretty places.
Well, now that Where the Wild Things Were is published, are you working on another project?
Well, yeah, I've gotten myself kind of interested in one of the aspects of the book that I cover, and that is some of the problems that are going on with islands and island conservation. And there's this, and predators are involved in that too, but in another way, in that a lot of them are invasive, and so they have the opposite effect in places where they're not native to, and where places are not the fauna's not used to them. So that looks like an interesting subject I'd like to tackle.
And if they're not native, were they brought there? Did they swim over, fly over?
Well, most cases we brought them. You know, we tend to do that. Whenever we sail the ocean blue, we take along with us, some rats or some cats or whatnot, or livestock, you know, some of them by choice. And then we release them on the islands, and then they go crazy. And, you know, they have their way with the island's naive fauna.
Well, thank you for joining me this morning. My guest is wildlife journalist and author William Stoltzenberg. His latest book is Where the Wild Things Were: Life, Death, and Ecological Wreckage in the Land of Vanishing Predators. Thank you. And thank you, Michelle, for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
I want to take the next 2 minutes of our show this morning to talk about something very important. The Endangered Species Act is, we have about a week to save our Endangered Species Act. This is just down from AlterNet this morning. And I'm not talking about specific species, but the act itself. The Bush administration is proposing redefinitions of terms that would allow conservative appointees and federal agencies to virtually destroy the act. This, again, is in from AlterNet this morning. Their goal is to allow proposed projects to proceed, even if such projects would kill off endangered species or place them or their habitats in jeopardy. If the changes are not effectively challenged by September 15th, that's 5 days, they will go into effect, and goodbye species. They're asking us to act now. And how you can go about doing that. The best way, not only to call your congressmen and women and call your state senators, Gordon Smith, Ron Wyden, but also the best way is to go to their website, which is www.regulations.gov, and use the search terms, and this is pretty complicated, use the search terms 50, C as in cat, F as in Frank, R, part 402, proposed rule. They're not making it easy, are they? If you can click on send a comment or submission to write your comment, every email is important. This way, the comments are going to be read, and they will be taken into consideration. And once more, a little bit background about this is that this is not being attacked by Congress or the courts or even by the president's executive orders. It's being destroyed by redefinition by a series of linguistic tricks. So once again, please help save the Environmental Species Act. You have until September 15th to go to the website, which once again is www.regulations.gov. And you might be able to search by putting Endangered Species Act in, but since this is a government, it's 50, C as in cat, F as in Frank, R as in Ralph, part 402, proposed rule. This has been Radio Zine. Have a wonderful day.
KBU is a proud co-sponsor of the 2008 Portland Grassroots Media Camp taking place September 12th through 14th. The Portland Grassroots Media Camp is a weekend of hands-on skill share,